Welcome back to Veterans Radio, broadcasting live from WDEO, our flagship station right here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And on the line with me is Mr. Dwight Zimmerman. Dwight, here it is, at ease, once again, another Saturday.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here, and hello to you and Nina.
And why don't you just take it from there, Dwight?
Will do. So this is Dwight Zimmerman, and we're broadcasting live from Studio 4F at Veterans Radio East in Brooklyn, New York. And I'm happy and proud to have as my guest today Sergeant First Class Joseph Kapicheski. He wrote an explosive memoir of a special operator who never gave up called Back in the Fight. It's an absolutely gripping story. And we have Matthew White, whose book Atrocities is a very good book about some very bad things. It talks about the 100 deadliest episodes in human history. It's a fascinating book. And I'm happy to welcome back best-selling author Larry Bond, whose latest novel, Shattered Trident, I couldn't put this darn thing down. So he'll be talking about this exciting thriller. And we will be back in just a moment to talk with our first guest, Sergeant Kapicheski. Or do you want me to go right into it, Nina?
Dwight, we should have the captain on the line right now.
Oh, great. So, Sergeant, are you there with us?
I am. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, welcome to At Ease. I'm so happy to have you here. You wrote a very, very powerful story here. It's your memoir, and I found it very difficult to, some of the things that you went through were just really emotionally wrenching, so I know that that had to be difficult to write, so I really respect what you did here. Could you summarize your service in the Army and the Rangers for our listeners, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of joined the military at the best time. I was a senior in high school, and I actually signed up on the delayed entry program in May of 2001, and they gave me a start date of September 17th. So, lo and behold, September 11th happened a week later. I was in basic training, went to airborne school, had an opportunity to try out for the Ranger Indoctrination Program. I was assigned to 3rd Ranger Battalion, and June of 2002, I did my first combat deployment to Afghanistan. Being in the Ranger Regiment, we have a very high operations tempo. So, 2005, I found myself on my 5th deployment in northern Iraq, and that's actually when I was injured. And mission came down the pipeline just like any other day. We're going to go out and kill or capture a high-value target, and en route to the objective, our convoy was ambushed. We were moving underneath the Nova Pass. We got ambushed from above, and we were receiving small arms fire, and they started to throw some grenades, and one of their grenades made it through the hatch of my vehicle and went off next to myself and my platoon leader at the time. So the first couple minutes were sort of chaotic, but, the training that we go through sort of kicked in, and everybody does Ranger First Responder is our medical training. It was one of my Ranger buddies who put a pressure dressing on my arm, which ultimately saved my life. After the docs tried to patch me up at Walter Reed for about 6 months, I had about 42 surgeries on my leg, and they weren't able to save it. So in March of 2007, they amputated my right leg below the knee.
Your story here, Back in the Fight, it also includes some anecdotes from your wife, Kimberly, that explain how this came about.
I really thought it was important to sort of tell her side of the story, just because she saw things differently, and she had a different perspective. And, some of the stuff when I was up at Walter Reed was a little bit foggy for me. And I've been very fortunate to sort of have her as a rock and as my supporter. So I thought it was very important to put her side in the book, so other women and other wives could see how a positive support structure can really help someone overcome adversity.
Yes, I felt that you and she did a very good job of relating how family members are affected by this. It's like, on the one side, you're in the middle of it, but there they are in this really awkward situation and emotionally wrenching one where they're on the sidelines and wanting to help, but it's a very difficult thing. And I felt that you and your wife did a very good job, bringing out all that emotion.
Yeah, and sometimes I feel like a lot of the wives of service members don't get the recognition they deserve for the sacrifices that they have to make. You know, I mean, when a service member is deployed and he's overseas, he pretty much takes all his roles and responsibilities at the house and he puts them onto her plate. You know, so now she's sort of dual hatting, and you know, when you have children and all the missed holidays and the unknown, is very difficult. And it definitely takes a special breed of woman to be able to handle that and be successful.
Yes, indeed. Where can our listeners get your book?
Most good bookstores have it, and they can also find it online.
Hey, you have a Facebook site, I see. I'm on it right now. Tell our listeners about that.
Yes, Kimberly was able to set it up. If you look around on the page, there's a place where you can go and you can actually donate a book to a wounded soldier. Part of me writing the book was to try to help motivate and inspire other wounded soldiers to sort of overcome the adversity that they're challenged with and, reach their potential. So we've got a setup where people can donate a book through the Facebook page to a wounded soldier, and as they do that, we get the books, and I try to sign them, and we hand them out, or we send them to some of the different medical centers across the country, and so some of the warrior transition units and warrior transition battalions.
Can you tell our listeners what the URL is for your Facebook site, please?
It's Joseph Kapachewski. JOSEPHKAPACZIEWSKI.
Okay, thank you very much for that. The whole process, when you were wounded, lying in the hospital, and then deciding on the amputation, you didn't, initially you resisted having the amputation done. Tell our listeners the reasons why.
Yeah, I waited almost 18 months from the date I was injured until they amputated my leg, and I didn't want to lose my leg. I was going to be a strong ranger, and I was going to heal up and be just fine, and that wasn't the case. You know, I tried to give it every opportunity I had to try to save my leg, but in the end, I had very limited range of motion, and I had chronic pain, so I wasn't the person I once was because the pain was so bad. And I couldn't get over how bad the pain was. And, being, 24, 25 years old at the time, I was, very young. I still wanted to live a very active lifestyle. So for me, electing to have the leg amputated below the knee was to be able to live that active lifestyle. And I was very fortunate to have a great doctor do the surgery, and it turned out fantastic. And when I went out to the Center for Intrepid at Brooke Army Medical Center, they literally taught me how to walk and run and skip and jump out of airplanes again. The care out there was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, tell our listeners about the therapy and then the other patients there who were also going through similar experiences.
There's a lot of service members that have been injured through the global war on terrorism. And, people look at me as a below-knee amputee, and I look at it a little bit different because I almost have a paper cut of an injury compared to a lot of the guys that are coming back. Being a below-knee amputee is nothing compared to, a bilateral amputee who is above the knee. He has a lot more challenges to overcome than I have. So, being an amputee, I probably have the least severe out of all of them. But it's looking at those other guys and seeing and talking to them. You know, they still have a desire to be a service member in whatever branch that they came from. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to stay and be able to deploy again, is because I would be physically able to do it. And some guys aren't physically able to do it. You know, they still have the desire to, but their body won't let them. So it's a huge motivation for me to be able to continue doing what I do.
Yeah, I was surprised at the high morale that these patients had. It was really impressive and touching.
It is. It's amazing how resilient service members can be. You know, and you know, I when I talk to the guys, I mean, it's, you know, they unfortunately, you know, they've got to play the cards that they've been dealt. And you've got to stay positive and keep a good attitude, you know, so you can be a productive part of society.
Yes. Okay. Now, you didn't only want to return, you know, to active duty. You wanted to return to active duty as a Ranger. Excuse me. Talk about the reaction that your superiors had when you made that known.
I made it known very early in my recovery when people would come up to the hospital at Walter Reed, you know, a month after I was injured, you know, and they asked me what I was going to do. I told them I was going to go back and be a Ranger Rifle Squad Leader, which is the job I had while I was injured. You know, and everyone, you know, shook their head and told me whatever I needed, they'd be there, and when I was ready, it would be fine. I didn't think it was going to take, you know, almost 2 years and over 40 surgeries for that to happen. And I met a little bit of resistance after I had my leg amputated, and I had the same goal of returning as a Ranger Rifle Squad Leader. You know, and they wanted to make sure that I would be able to stand up physically to the strains that we see overseas. So they made me requalify on all the Ranger standards, which consists of an APFT, Army Physical Fitness Test, doing push-ups, sit-ups, 2 mile run, and we also do pull-ups. We also have a 5 mile standard run in under 40 minutes, and then we do a 12 mile road march at about 45 pounds of gear in under 3 hours. So I was able to do all of those, and then they wanted to make sure that I could still fast rope out of the helicopter, which was a little bit more difficult than I thought, just because I don't get any friction with my feet. And we wear leather work gloves, so the first time I did it, when I got to the bottom of the rope, my hands were on fire. So, you know, you adapt and overcome, and now I just wear two sets of gloves whenever I fast rope. And then it was making sure that I could conduct airborne operations, so I did a couple airborne jumps out of a Black Hawk helicopter, and once I sort of figured out how my prosthetic was going to act, we put some combat equipment on and did a couple jumps out of the C-130, and once I was able to do all that, I just needed to wait for a couple key leaders to be in the right position within the Ranger Regiment, and they gave me the opportunity to go back and lead Rangers into combat.
And you did go into combat. Tell our listeners about that experience.
It was great. My first deployment back as an amputee, I worked in a Joint Operations Center. And my second one back, I got to lead Rangers into combat again, which was great. And I got promoted, and I was able to take a platoon sergeant position and got to do another 3 rotations to Afghanistan as a platoon sergeant. And I was very fortunate to have exceptional Rangers that were very technically and tactically proficient, and it was just, you know, a dream come true for me, and it was an amazing experience.
Ah, man, I mean, I'm just in absolute awe of what you've been able to accomplish and everything. Sergeant, I'm speechless. What can I say? Well, thank you for being a guest on our program. I've been talking with Sergeant First Class Joseph Kapicheski. His book, Back in the Fight, The Explosive Memoir of a Special Operator Who Never Gave Up, is an absolutely riveting story, and I am just so happy that you were able to take the time to be my guest here on At Ease.
I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Okay. So we have our next guest lined up. That's correct, Nina?
That is correct. I can put him on the air in just one second here.
Okay. And my next guest is Matthew White, whose book is Atrocities, the 100 Deadliest Episodes in Human History. And it's a very good book about a bunch of very bad things. Matthew, are you on the line now?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Welcome to At Ease.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. I was just, it's hard to use the word fascinated and entertained, but this is a very entertaining book. You have a wonderful writing style.
Thanks. I did try and explain things very well, yes.
Oh, you did. You did that. And I was especially impressed with the fact that you didn't get overwhelmed by these horrible things that happened. So tell our listeners about Atrocities.
Well, I'd had a website, the Historical Atlas of the 20th Century, for many years on Internet. And one of the reoccurring arguments was, what was the worst thing that happened? Because, the 20th century is full of wars and dictators. And were there connections? Are there patterns? Were there any, what could we learn, take away from these things? And during the course of the arguments, I started collecting statistics, just straight out death tolls, and making lists and trying to see if there were patterns to it. And eventually I decided to just write it up, the 100 worst things, and to try and keep them in, give you a historical perspective across time of what's happened since the beginning of records.
Yes, we go from ancient to present time. What's the earliest of your atrocities?
That would be the Second Persian War, the invasion by Xerxes that included the Battle of Thermopylae, Battle of Salamis. I found estimates of about 300,000 people were killed during those wars.
Yes, in fact, 300,000 is your baseline. Why did you pick that number?
It just sort of, it sort of fell out that way once I started tallying and listing the 100. 300,000 seemed to be what it took to be on the list. That was number 100.
Yes, and what's the most recent of the atrocities in the book?
It would be the Second Congo War, which so many people never even heard of. It happened in the 90s and the early 2000s. It was a civil war in the Congo, in the larger of the two Congos. It involved an invasion by Rwanda and Uganda chasing rebels into the Congo, and then it just sort of degenerated into a civil war. And they sort of have a ceasefire, but it doesn't always work out that way. But it's about 3 million, 4 million people were killed during that war.
Wow. So where did it rank, in your standings?
Let me look up the precise rank. It was, I think it's around 20 or 30. But yes, it's around 25th.
Okay, I noticed that the book comes in at 669 pages, and I have to chide your publisher. I said, he should have really reworked it to come in at 666 pages.
That's a good point. Yes.
When this thing goes into another edition, talk to him about that. Okay, I noticed that instead of presenting these atrocities in a numerical order from 100 up to number 1, you group them differently. Explain how you came about deciding your sections?
Well, actually, it's chronologically. I did sort of sort them occasionally by certain topics, but that were, and I do have little essays in the middle of sort of a long run of things like, you know, religious wars or the crazed tyrants of the 20th century or the wars following the liberation of Africa, and the communism was another. But, generally I go chronologically so that I can kind of build up the background knowledge that in order to go from one to the other.
Yeah, but at the end I noticed that you did actually list them, you know, so that anyone who just wanted to see how everything ranked, that was a quick reference, and I appreciated that.
Yes.
I noticed that repeatedly you would, I'll call it, hedge your bets with regards to the actual death tolls. Explain how that came about, please.
Well, they're really, most of these are estimates, and especially in the older ones, it's hard to be precise. And generally speaking, I took estimates from modern historians. I didn't just take, like, what an ancient historian said. I went to modern history books, and if they kind of agreed with it or if they said this is too high, too low. But generally speaking, people are all – scholars vary on even the most recent ones. Saddam Hussein, I ranked him at killing 300,000, but it could be anywhere from 250,000 to 500,000, depending on which expert you go by. And that pretty much occurs throughout history. American Civil War, World War II, they all have variable estimates. And so I generally went with the middle one or the most common one. I tried not to pick the real extremes, just to be on the safe side.
You have a website which people can look at for atrocities, correct?
Yes, I do. It's necrometrics.com.
Okay, I'm also looking at one here called bookofhorriblethings.com.
Oh, yes, that's specific to the book, but yes.
Okay, so let's see. Yeah, when you were talking about the different takes on death tolls, I was fascinated by the controversies surrounding Joseph Stalin. Explain that, please.
Well, that for years we had no idea how many he killed because the Soviet Union was closed, all the archives were locked up, we had no information, no direct information, just sort of stories that would filter out. And it was obvious he had killed many, countless numbers. And so some of the estimates do go as high as 60 million, but general those are like Cold War estimates, where people pretty much took a guess at the scale of his dictatorship. And then there are also the minimizers, the ones who, you have to have absolute total proof. They really don't believe the higher ones. And so if there's officially recorded, I think like 900,000 officially recorded executions that we now know about because we've had been able to study the archives, and maybe 1.5 million estimates or actually recorded deaths in the gulag, but obviously those are the only the ones we have records of, and a lot of records are lost, so I went more with the middle ground, the 20 to 30 million, which has become sort of the more common estimate as the more we learn about it.
Yes, there were even some people who, I'll call them the bean counters, as it were, who would only take the actual hard number.
Right.
Which I thought was, they're almost like Stalin apologists.
And there were Stalin apologists for years, but most of them have been discredited now. But yes, you're right, they are minimizers.
Okay, well, we're approaching our break right now, so I'm talking with Matthew White about his book, Atrocities, The 100 Deadliest Episodes in Human History. And we'll have Matthew back with us right after our break. So, Bob and Nina, take it away, please.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Sergeant David Bleek, although a medical aid man, killed three North Korean soldiers and disarmed two more. Details after this.
I am a United States sailor.
I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, and I will obey the orders of those appointed over me.
I represent the fighting spirit of the Navy and those who have gone before me to defend freedom and democracy around the world.
I proudly serve my country's Navy combat team with honor, courage, and commitment. I am committed to excellence and the fair treatment of all.
I am a United States sailor.
Bleek volunteered to accompany a reconnaissance patrol committed to engage the enemy and capture a prisoner for interrogation. Forging up the rugged slope of the key terrain, the group was subjected to intense automatic weapons and small arms fire and suffered several casualties. After administering to the wounded, Bleek continued to advance with the patrol. Nearing the crest of the hill while attempting to cross the fire-swept area to attend the wounded, he came under hostile fire from a small group of the enemy concealed in a trench. Entering the trench, he closed with the enemy, killed two with his bare hands, and a third with his trench knife. Moving from the emplacement, Bleek saw a concussion grenade fall in front of a companion and, quickly shifting his position, shielded the man from the impact of the blast. Later, while ministering to the wounded, a hostile bullet struck him, but, despite the wound, Bleek undertook to evacuate the wounded comrade. As he moved down the hill with his heavy burden, two enemy soldiers with fixed bayonets attacked him. Closing with the aggressors, he grabbed them and smacked their heads together, then carried his helpless comrade down the hill to safety. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com. Oh, we're back on Veterans Radio. We'll be right with Dwight just a second. I do want to make a correction on that air show that's coming up August 10th and 11th. If you've got a pencil, you want to write this down, yankeeairmuseum.org/airshow. That's yankeeairmuseum.org/airshow for all the information on the air show, Thunder Over Michigan. And now, at ease, and Dwight Zimmerman. Dwight?
Thank you, Bob. I am talking with my guest, Matthew White. We're discussing his book, Atrocities, The 100 Deadliest Episodes in Human History, that is available at bookstores everywhere and online, and he has his website, www.bookofhorriblethings.com. Matthew, I appreciate if you could tell our listeners the names of the different sections in your book and explain those themes, please.
Okay. There are, let's see, let me find the table. There are some common groupings. There's, for instance, genocide is one of the groups, and that would be the outright destruction of ethnic groups, basically. the Holocaust is the standard one. The there's also destruction of the American Indian is sometimes counted in that. And there's also World Conquerors is one that gets a great deal of common threads. Napoleon is Alexander the Great, such as that, and religious killings, the Crusades, the Seven Years' War are standard examples of that. Communism was a common theme throughout some of these. Mao was probably the worst individual dictator and the worst of the communist dictators. Most of his were, though, by famine, caused by mismanagement. And Stalin was second. The Khmer Rouge in Cambodia was one. There's the Cold War is another grouping that kind of Vietnam War, Korean War, the war in Afghanistan, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So I do try and, you know, see common threads in those. Tyrants, again, that's the sort of the outright killing of political enemies. Stalin is kind of the standard one. Hitler, of course. Saddam Hussein, Idi Amin. These are people that... it really does cross the spectrum of different reasons, different causes. I didn't really find any single way that these things are... any single cause, any single way of unfolding or pattern to them. I did find that the breakdown of society is one of the most destructive, causes many, many more deaths than almost anything else. You know, the Chinese Civil War, the chaos, various Chinese dynasties, when they break down, that sort of thing.
Okay, so I know our listeners are wondering who or what came in at number one.
Well, obviously it would be the Second World War. I mean, that's not a big surprise, because you had, you know, the entire world, very destructive weapons, the very destructive ideologies, you know, fascism, communism, various militaristic factions in Japan. So, yes, that was about 65 million people died in that one. And then second would be, it was a tie, Genghis Khan and Mao Zedong both killed around 40 million people. Genghis Khan, we kind of know that from archaeology, just that, and census records, because the Chinese kept very meticulous records. So we see millions of people disappear after he's been through and invading. And then Mao Zedong also tied with 40 million for second place, and he was, most of his was famine when he restructured the Great Leap Forward, when he restructured industry and agriculture in China. It caused a huge famine, worst in history. And third was, actually not many people know about it, but there were famines in British India repeatedly, and a lot of it was because the British would export all the crops to Great Britain, and if there was a drought or something, there was no backup, there was no surplus for them to handle it, and so thousands or millions, tens of millions of Indians starved over the course of 100 years.
Yeah, that one I have to say did really surprise me. Excuse me. excuse me. It ran counter to everything that I thought I knew about Britain's colonial empire.
Yes, it really was. They did exploit the Indians pretty thoroughly. And sadly, yes.
Okay, Matthew, we're coming up to the end of our interview time. I want to thank you so much for being on my show.
I've
been talking to Matthew White and his book, Atrocities, The 100 Deadliest Episodes in Human History. So good luck with this.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Okay, and Nina, we are going on to our next guest, Larry Bond.
Okay, Mr. Bond should be on the line now.
Oh, thank you so much. Larry, are you there?
Dwight, it's good to hear from you. How are you?
Welcome back, Larry. I'm so happy to have you here again.
Oh, I love it. I was fascinated by your last guest. I had no idea about that book. I seriously have to pick that up.
Oh, you do. You do. It sounds awful to say, but it is such a fun and fascinating read. He's looks at the causes and everything. It's not a dry, pedantic gloom and doom listing. I mean, obviously, it's a deadly, a very deadly book, but when you want to study the history of mankind, this is definitely one of the first books you need to read. But we need to talk about your book, Shattered Trident.
I would love to talk about my book, Shattered Trident.
Okay, so give us a summary of the plot here, please.
Well, Shattered Trident is the fourth book in the Jerry Mitchell series. For people who aren't familiar with it, think Horatio Hornblower, but submarines instead of sailing ships. And Jerry's advanced through his career, and in his fourth book, he's now skipper of his own boat, USS North Dakota, which is a brand-new Flight 3 Virginia class. It's still got the new car smell on it. Jerry is doing something that U.S. submarines routinely do, which is surveil the other side, and he's trailing a Chinese submarine. He has no hostile intent. His entire job is just to practice not being seen, as they say in Monty Python, and watch what he does and learn. And in the process, he sees the Chinese submarine torpedo a Vietnamese merchant ship. His immediate reaction is ET phone home, and what he's seen is the beginning of a shooting war between China and Vietnam and the other littoral nations that surround the South China Sea.
Yes, well, this thing, the Littoral Alliance, you have a knack of, as the cliche goes, you know, torn from today's headlines, but we have today China flexing its hegemony in the region, and we have the Spratly Islands and other conflicts there. So tell us about these nations along the Pacific Rim that are getting into this grouping to fight China.
Well, the Littoral Alliance, which we created in the book, it was almost a natural outgrowth of what's going on over there right now in the real world. I like the term hegemony, because that's really what China seems to be trying to do. If all the nations in that region have differing claims to different groups of islands, there's the Senkaku, there's the Spratlys, there's the Diu Islands, they're all little specks of rock that aren't even necessarily dry at high tide. But they surround or are on top of oil deposits, fishing grounds, possible minerals, things that these countries, which are usually, third world or developing countries, need to, help their economy grow. Of course, China would like those same resources. Her economy's been on a tremendous growth spurt, and so she needs the oil, she needs the resources, she always needs the food. Chinese fishermen have been very active in the area. Oh, is there supposed to be a border here? Oh, gee, I guess we're on the wrong side of that border. Well, that's just too bad. The Chinese have claimed officially the entire South China Sea as their exclusive economic zone. And for people who don't understand the term, national territorial waters go out 12 nautical miles. Beyond that, out to 200 nautical miles, international law recognizes an exclusive economic zone. Your country is allowed to fish, mine, and use those waters exclusively out to 200 nautical miles. Well, I can tell you that the South China Sea extends far further than 200 nautical miles from China. China just says, oh, that's all ours, because there was a Chinese ship that beached itself in the Spratlys in medieval times, so we claimed it.
Okay.
They're being very sorry,
Larry. I'm afraid we're coming on to our break next. Right, that's right, Bob.
Okay, that's right. We'll be right back with Dwight Zimmerman and his guests right after this very important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Dwight, take it away from Brooklyn.
Thank you so much, Bob. I have as my guest here Larry Bond, who's talking about his latest thriller, Shattered Trident. Larry, where can our listeners get this book?
Well, it came out May 7th, and it should be available through all the regular bookstore chains and, of course, online retailers like Barnes & Noble and Amazon, etc. And it's still available on hardcover if you want to go out and grab that. Softcover's a little bit further out. Of course, ebook editions are available right now.
And you have a website, too, correct?
Yeah, larry-bond.com, and I'm on Facebook. And I answer questions and talk to people all the time. So, I work alone. You know, I don't get out a lot sitting out there in my office typing. So, you know, it's nice when people, you know, say, hey, this and hey, that. And you always get somebody who was there and says, you know, it doesn't really, you know, I got caught on a couple of bloopers regarding small arms or the way the V-22 operates. And, you know, I appreciate the feedback, especially now that there's e-books. I can actually go back and fix the passage and make it correct.
Yes, that does make things easier. And I can certainly identify with the hermit-like life that an author leads. Now, let's get back to Jerry Mitchell and his problems, because he's literally caught in the middle of this, and it starts out as a covert shooting war.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the dynamic of the war was very interesting. The Chinese Navy is, for your readers, is building up very rapidly from what was a coast defense navy to a regional navy. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to be sending deployments into the Gulf of Mexico or the Norwegian Sea. But we are seeing Chinese ships, for instance, show up on anti-piracy patrols in the Gulf of Aden or making port calls in Pakistan. This is what a regional navy does. First of all, they you know, work in their own immediate area, and then they sort of go out and see what's going on around them. But for some reason, their anti-submarine warfare and their submarine warfare capabilities are still very, very poor. And this is well-known and widely known, and it's interesting because all the navies around that border, the South China Sea, have really good submarine arms. They've bought first-class boats from the Germans or the Russians. For instance, Vietnam operates Kilo-class submarines, Project 636. They're very capable. The Japanese have the sorter U class submarines, which they build themselves, and they're very capable. And so it's an interesting mismatch. And these countries in our story recognize, China has a plot going where they're going to seize all these contested islands. They're tired of these negotiations. They're just going to seize the whole thing. That is made up, but isn't that far-fetched considering their current attitude? So these literal countries form an alliance, and they use their submarines to try and coerce China into abandoning its plan by sinking all their oil tankers. And I'm giving away like about the first five chapters of the book, but nowhere near the ending. Don't worry about it. And basically, they go around raising hell and destruction and try and tell the Chinese, abandon this. Of course, the Chinese are not easily convinced, and the shooting war. Where is Jerry in all this? Well, Jerry is stationed on a submarine that is operating in this area, and because not everything is clear at first what's going on, we send Jerry in, and this is what we do with submarines, to try and figure out what's going on. I mean, to scout, to explore, to see what's what. After a while, when he does figure out what's going on, we realize that there's this tremendous war going on between our friends and our biggest trading partner. And, you know, the story is whoever wins, everybody loses. If the Chinese lose and their society, and their economy breaks down, as is the literal alliance's aim, world trade as a whole will suffer, and everybody will suffer a tremendous recession. You want to talk about jobs. On the other hand, if the literal alliance loses, Japan, Taiwan, other trading partners that we had, their economies are going to go down the tubes, and we're just as bad off. And by the way, their loss also affects China. A hidden lesson in my book is that we're all too tightly together, tied by trade and everything else for us to go around shooting at each other. It's just not a wise course of action.
I do have to say that when I started reading this thing, it was love-hate, sort of situation because, and I've told you this before, I know I'm going to have a great, gripping, wonderful, story, but then I'm going to have a devil of a time putting the darn thing down.
you say the nicest things, Dwight.
Well, it was true.
I'm serious.
I plowed through this thing. I thank God I do, I work at home, and I, of course, it wrecked my schedule for 2 days. it was that exciting.
Well, thank you. I mean, an author's goal is really to deprive people of an honest night's sleep, and nothing makes me happier than to know that you were that engrossed and immersed in the story. I mean, we work very hard for that total just enveloping you and surrounding you with a story. And that's high praise. Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Well, also, the thing is that this is the, the last story, in your series. You definitely go out with a bang. I was very impressed with that. The tension is right up until the last chapter, and you wrap things up so nicely. There's a reason they're called thrillers.
Well, the rule in this genre is you get to knock the props out in chapter one. You get to do things and mess up the world in chapter one, and then everything else should proceed reasonably from that. So the thrill part is in knowing that this is only, this could be happening in another multiverse somewhere else, that everything's this real-world gear, real-world reactions and decisions. Now, of course, every author tries to have his characters behave realistically. People shouldn't focus on the hardware too much. The hardware is fun, but it's there for the same reason that there are horses in a Western, so that the hero can get around and do his job. We don't spend a lot of time talking about tech. I mean, we could have spent a lot more time on the technology, and we deliberately dialed it back because I think people are more interested in characters
than they are in hardware.
You're quite right there, but obviously in things like this, it's good that an author actually knows the difference between an M16 and an M4, or between a Kilo-class submarine and an Ohio-class. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I also have a stable of friends and associates and readers who will tell me if I forget what the difference is between a magazine and a clip, for instance, or things like that. All my stuff gets read by a lot of people before it gets on the street to make sure that I do have all the technical details right. And
okay.
Like, for instance, with – I'm sorry, go.
No, we're almost at the end of our time. So what's your next project?
Well, I'm working on another book with Chris Carlson, the same fellow I did the Jerry Mitchell series with, and I'm not going to tell you anything about it because it's still way too early. And I'm on chapter 10, so I don't want to give too much away.
Okay. Well,
we've had a lot of feedback on Jerry Mitchell.
Yes.
I'm not saying there won't. Fourth was the plan end, but we've had so many positive responses. We might try and figure a way for him to come back. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Larry, I'm so happy to have you again on our show, and we'll definitely have you on with your next book. I've been talking to Larry Bond and his latest thriller, Shattered Trident, which is available in bookstores everywhere. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much for having me, Dwight.
Okay, Bob, back at you. We've got an exciting program for next week.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you again for having the guests that you go out and bring on your program. Just interesting, the kind of stuff that we want to keep, kind of information that we want to keep giving out here at Veterans Radio and keep us current. Okay, well, we've got about 3 minutes, Dwight. Yes, and we do have Gettysburg. It's the 150th, am I correct, 150th anniversary of the beginning. And, well, did you write a book on that?
I have written about Gettysburg, yes, and I've worked with one of our foremost experts on the Civil War. I was his editor on the American Heritage History of the Battle of Gettysburg, Craig Simons, who is going to be your guest on the program. And I'm really happy that Craig was a guest on an earlier episode of At Ease, and he's very articulate, very engaging. He's former head of the history department at Annapolis, and he is going to, he'll have so much information, and I hope that listeners will call in and ask questions, because he'll be an entertaining guest.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. But is there somewhere that our listeners can go online and get the material that you wrote? Do you have that somewhere online where they can pick that up?
Oh, I would say that you punch our listeners, if they punch my name in Amazon.
What's your
right
name
now?
Completely? I think you have to spell Zimmerman.
Oh, yes. I mean, I've written it in so many different forms. Usually it's been included in other parts of the projects. For instance, in my graphic biography, The Hammer and the Anvil, I devote some space to Gettysburg. It's I've done chapters and other aspects of it. So sometimes I forget where all my stuff has appeared.
Okay, so it's Dwight, D-W-I-G-H-T, Zimmerman, Z-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N. Did I get that right?
You did, Bob.
And you know what that means in German, Zimmerman?
It's room man.
Well, I thought it was carpenter.
It's carpenter. I mean, literally, Zimmer is room. But, it is carpenter.
Okay, well, we've got 30 seconds to go. Dwight, I'm looking forward to that. I'm as much as I can get up to speed on Gettysburg. There's so much to cover. It was a huge, huge event in the history of our wonderful country and the history of the world. So, once again, everybody, This is Veterans Radio. Dwight Zimmerman and my partner, Dale Throneberry. We'll see you next week. Gettysburg, until that time, you are dismissed.